these questions sections, and you know, I can't quite ask you the same question because it's not not like you've already done this. You've already created some games that you really think are great, and you've kind of done the game that you want to make in some ways. But what I'll ask you is, if you could make some sort of like, if you had the potential or the opportunity to work within any sort of like, let's say any sort of gaming media, so you could stick with Twine, you could move on to something you know, way more graphical, whatever you wanted. Assume you have all the various materials or personnel or skills to make it happen. Some sort of hypothetical.
Right.
What is the game that you would most like to see in the world, or you would most like to create?
I've sort of thought about going more graphical a lot of the time, and it just doesn't happen because mostly I don't have the time to sort of invest in like learning all of the skills I would need for doing things like that. But I have always wanted to do a kind of adventure type game, not like straight up adventure game, but I would say something like in the tradition of like the way Kentucky Route Zero approaches adventure games.
Okay.
Right. I actually like, I being kind of a creative, I have all of these various ideas, all of these sort of like stories that I want to tell. And I know like specifically the story that I would tell with this adventure game, right, which would be kind of like my tribute to Satoshi Kon. I don't know if you're familiar with his work.
What is some of it?
He was an animator. He passed away a few years ago, quite sadly and unexpectedly. But he did like Paranoia Agent, Paprika, Tokyo yes. Godfathers. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
The name sounded familiar, but yes, I know Paprika and Paranoia Agent.
Right. So he does this thing that I just love, which is kind of the like late era like consumer culture like reality bending, like, you know, sort of like consumer culture fantasies like invading reality and that sort of thing. And I've always wanted to tell a story sort of in that vein, a kind of like noirish mystery story about a woman searching for her missing boyfriend who was like a famous children's book author. And like, yeah, no, like I have basically the entire plot is like in my head. I just would need to have like the time, the money, and the resources to like make this thing a kind of, because it has to be, right? This is not a thing that I could do in Twine. I know exactly how this would work, and I know why it wouldn't work in Twine.
Right.
And just in case like I ever do get it made, I'm not going to talk any more about it, but.
Yeah, no, please don't. I just so you maintain the secrecy and the,
yeah.
But yeah, I like that you're the first person who has answered that question. This is why I like answering this question. I get so many different answers, but you're the first person who's answered that question with like almost a credible threat. Like, here's the game I'll make. Like, and it's cool. Like, I would love to play it.
Yeah.
I like also that let me make this the second question. So you have this element of, we talked a little bit about this in the main podcast, this element of mystery in your work. Where you know, one of the things people complained about, you said in My Father's Long Long Legs, is that it didn't follow through on it didn't answer the mystery in any sort of like clear way, right?
Mm-hmm.
People were sort of frustrated by that or whatever, which is not an uncommon complaint for things that don't give like concrete answers, but there seems to be mystery in a lot of your work, and like even in the sort of like thing you mentioned there, the sort of idea, the germ of an idea, or the, we'll pretend it's a germ, but the fully fleshed out idea you have about the missing children's book author has a sort of mystery element to it. And I'm wondering what your relationship is to the kind of like mystery genre or the concept of deduction in your own work.
So I guess this is interesting, because I have never written like what I would call a mystery, like a straight up mystery. Right. And I think part of this is because I tend to be, more interested in questions than in answers, to be pretty glib about it. But also, there's a kind of like anticipation of other people's logic, I think, that, mystery requires, that just tends to be kind of exhausting for me. Like me writing a mystery is me thinking like, okay, like where are all the plot holes that people are going to like give me shit over?
Right.
And again, I'm like more interested in like scene and effect and like mood, rather than like mystery in kind of like the old sense, right? Mystery in the medieval, like religious sense,
okay.
Rather than like mystery in the sense of ratiocination. Yeah, so I mean, I think to some more context here, right? A few years back, after The Uncle Who Works for Nintendo came out, I was contacted by, not going to say the name, a production company out of Hollywood that was interested in optioning it for film rights.
Wow.
And yeah, no, it was really cool. It was like the most surreal experience of my life up until this point, I think. But we had basically a phone conversation, and they were asking me a lot of questions about sort of the game and kind of like what it's about and sort of its backstory. And nothing really ever came of this, because it became clear to me as we were sort of talking that the story they were looking for was something with a lot of lore, a lot of okay. Sort of backstory with kind of like franchise potential.
Yeah.
And in the same way as with My Father's Long, Long Legs, like there's no lore, right? It's just a thing that's happening to me. And so I guess that's part of the other issue, is that I, aside from just like the general idea of mystery, right, coming at this from another generic standpoint of like horror, mm-hmm. there's a way in which if a horror story starts being too sort of lore heavy, if things start getting too explained, one, for me at least, it becomes less frightening.
Absolutely.
Because number two, it starts moving basically into like a fantasy novel territory, right? Where there's this world and things are like weird and thrilling, but also there is a logic to it, right? This thing was designed, and like the thing that is always like more compelling to me is something like The Uncle Who Works for Nintendo or My Father's Long, Long Legs, which is just like, here's this, you know, big ass monster that's gonna like do something. Like, how are you gonna deal with that, right? It doesn't matter where it came from exactly. Like the what you need to do is like respond to it here and now. So in that way, I feel like that influences like my approach to thinking about mystery as well. In the sense that like I don't really necessarily delight in like setting up this perfect situation where like all of the clues might be doled out and then everyone can put things together. Although I do like hints, right? If you're familiar with Gene Wolfe, the science fiction writer?
Yes.
Okay. I really love, like, I love Gene Wolfe books. I could never write a Gene Wolfe book where it's like, okay, if you look up this word, you'll notice that it comes from Greek, which means this, which then implies that the thing that he's using it to describe is actually this other thing. Like, these really abstruse literary puzzles that Gene Wolfe puts together. I admire them. I love them. I could never write them. because there's like a, there's almost, I mean that there's a coherence to that, that like I feel is just like uninteresting or like not necessarily like useful for dealing with reality all of the time.
Right. Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, it speaks to this quality of, you know, I always have considered police procedurals to be, which I mean, you know, I'm sure this marks me as a pretty bad radical that I would, or a pretty bad leftist that I would be interested in watching this many police procedurals. But I think there are many of us who do this. But I always found them to be kind of comfort food. And part of the reason they're comfort food is because it's the same reason that for a long time video games were comfort food to me, and that like my day job for a long time and even still in a lot of ways is being an academic and doing research and all this work, which is like, as you know, and as I've probably said a million times, is like mostly just asking questions. It's never actually coming to any sort of serious, like it can be coming to conclusions, but there's always something else you need to do.
Right.
It's not like you can clock out.
Right.
Whereas in a video game, there are discrete tasks, and in a mystery, there are discrete solutions. I think like that uncovering that, like that feeling of completion is a vicarious thrill. But also probably something I would agree with you, like not existentially important
right.
in the way that probably if I wrote fiction or was able to write fiction, I would want to put into my own work.
Right. I mean, like, you know, personally speaking, as someone who feels like my life has just been screaming chaos, right, which might be a bit of a hyperbole, right, but there's just kind of like stuff is just happening to me.
Sure.
Right. Like, that's what I'm interested in sort of communicating to people through like my creative work, especially, right? That sense that stuff is just kind of like not necessarily feeling totally disempowered, but right, that sense of being sort of like out of joint with the world or like the flow of your life or something like that. Because for me, that's very validating to be like, okay, I'm not the only person who is a totally anxious wreck.
Right. Yeah, it's a way of understanding like external forces in a sense that says like, look, I'm not saying I'm totally without agency, but I'm also saying I'm not totally with agency.
Right.
Interesting. So one last question, and then I will let you go. My final question is, I ask the academics always something about academia. It's my my true weakness. I waffled on a number of questions here, including asking you what your favorite Shakespeare play was, but then I decided that's just too
easy.
Annoying. Too easy. I hate answering questions about what my favorite thing is. I always pick one and I never really feel it with any conviction. So let me ask this: for people who are listening to this podcast, for people who are sort of like interested in video games and the way that like interactive art works, and you know, thinking about that on a sort of like aesthetic level sometimes, or like a functional, or however you understand this podcast to be, what early modern play would you think is the play that they would most appreciate?
Okay. I mean, this is kind of difficult.
It's a tough one.
Yeah. I mean, so the difficulty here, right, is that if you are not familiar with early modern plays generally, then stuff outside of the main canon can be a little dense and weird.
It can be very weird. You have to read the footnotes.
Right. So, I mean, I would almost say, I mean, really, like, I already mentioned this, right, but Night of the Burning Pestle is definitely the one to sort of, because that's the one that, like, will just turn around the entire way that you kind of, like, the received way of thinking about how the theater would have worked in Shakespeare's time, right?
Right.
Because we have this, like the people, like the groundlings, get up on the stage and start demanding and dictating how the action of the play is going. And also worth keeping in mind, right, is that this play, for whatever reason, was a total failure.
Huh.
Like, people hated it. And we don't really know why. But like, when it gets published, Beaumont, the author, says something in like his front matter, says something about how people missed what he calls the privy mark of irony.
Huh.
And it's not clear, like, what is, like, usually when plays do badly in this time period, right, they'll say, it's always the audience's fault, right? That's the author's position. It's always the audience's fault for some reason.
Sure. Well, why not?
And it's usually like, oh, you just weren't good enough at reading this play. But, like, sometimes you can get a sense where, like, oh, this play was censored because some aristocrat, like, saw it or heard about it and thought it was about them, right? This happens with, like, Ben Jonson a lot, where, like...
Poor Ben Jonson.
Yeah. Where it seems like something is taken as a satire, even though he doesn't intend it as a satire, so he says, and so he gets in trouble. With Night of the Burning Pestle, it's always fascinated me, like, who didn't like this play, right? Like, what was going on that this wasn't successful? Like, was it too weird? Is it something that, like, could only be appreciated in hindsight? So I would say, yeah, if you're interested in this sort of thing, like media and interactive artwork and things like that, go for Night of the Burning Pestle by Francis Beaumont, and just, you know, ask yourself that question as you're reading it, like, why did this fail the first time? Because it's got something of an afterlife now, right?
Yeah, sure.
But, like, what is this thing doing, and what was it doing, or what was it maybe doing in kind of its moment that either wasn't appreciated, or what was it doing that kind of, like, went off the rails in a certain way?
Hmm. Yeah, I wonder if there's something there about, like, artwork that initially fails. I'm thinking, when you say that, I'm thinking of Herman Melville's final two novels, which I don't know if you've read them, but if anyone's looking for a good novel recommendation, late Herman Melville,
yeah.
The Confidence Man, His Masquerade, is one of the weirder and best novels I've read. You haven't by chance read it?
I'm not familiar with late Melville, unfortunately.
So it's not so far off in some ways from the Privy Mark of Irony that Beaumont kind of talks about. And you know, this is post Moby Dick. This is when he's like utterly squandered all of the goodwill that his early sea stories have given him, and also all the money. And it's basically this book about a confidence man, a con man, on a ship full of people. But it's these series of vignettes, and the con is never quite clear what exactly it is or what the point of it is. It's never clear who the con man is. And like, the whole book is just filled with all what Melville sees as confidence schemes, which are like money, narrative, like characterization. And like he kind of just like knocks down every god in the book as he goes along.
Yeah.
In this totally like alienating piece. And then after that, he writes this love story, quote unquote love story, called Pierre, which critics deride as just like completely insane. I think they use the term insane. Like they assume Melville has been taken up with insanity. And he dies penniless. And I think there's something there might be something like really interesting about thinking of the ways we talk about video games and the ways that these things, that these sort of like aberrant pieces of art that people don't like, how they line up. Because I mean, you mentioned earlier in the podcast about this multimodal quality, and I wonder if that has something to do with like our inability to sort of access something the first time through.
I think that's actually a really good idea, right? That there's, if we're of the party of Marshall McLuhan, right? The best art, yes, the best artists are actually prophets, right? Mm. And they're always misread or misrecognized in their own time because they're speaking to a future that has yet to unfold. My fourth chapter is all about McLuhan and Shakespeare. So,
we're hitting all your chapters. This is good. Yeah. This speaks well to your dissertation that you were able to talk about it without even talking about it.
Yeah.
Huh. Well, that's an interesting final thought to end on. I'm gonna have to, if I spin that out a little bit, we're gonna have to have you back on to either agree or excoriate me.
Okay.
You can be a mean academic on that one if you want. I give you permission. But thanks again for coming on. Thanks for answering these final questions. Please come back again. It was a pleasure. Follow Michael at Warren is Dead on Twitter. His itch.io is ztul.itch.io. And what was the name of your site again? Correlated Content?
Yeah, it's correlatedcontents.com.
All right, Correlated Contents with an S. Yep. And play all those games.
Yes, thank you. It's been great.
It's really been fun.